So, welcome back, everybody, to this fifth podcast in our challenge series, which of course follows in the footsteps of Anne Boleyn and Henry VIII, but he's really just a minor character in all of this, as we follow on the Reformation progress. How have you been doing, everybody? Have you been making good progress? And indeed, have you been keeping up with the challenge? As Vanessa threw down the gauntlet to you all, I know, at the beginning of this podcast series, to see if you could keep up with the progress as it moved through all of these different counties in England that we've been following. Well, I hope you've been having a good time. And we are back here, as I say, for this fifth podcast. And I am joined once again by Natalie. Hello, Natalie.
Hello, Sarah. Hello, everyone. It's so lovely to be back with you all.
Yes, it is. Here we are. And in fact, this is your final time, isn't it? You will be leaving us at the end of the progress today. Well, not at the end of the progress, but the end at this stage of the progress, I should say.
Exactly. Yes. So I'm looking forward to my last little journey with you all.
Now, maybe we just say just a quick recap. Last time, the progress took us to Winchester. And of course, that was one of the kind of the center stage, the centerpiece event of this particular progress. A favorite place of ours. It's a lovely place, isn't it? Winchester's got some fantastic history there.
Yeah, absolutely. Layers of history. So, you know, whatever you like, I'm sure is covered in Winchester.
And in fact, I'm going to be going back soon again, actually, just in about 2 months' time. So another opportunity to go. I haven't been in quite a while, so I'll look forward to that.
Very lucky. I wish I could join you, Sarah.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe soon. I know you have plans to head back this way. But anyway, that's for another conversation, I think. So on this leg of the journey, we are going to be going on progress from Winchester, and we're going to be kind of meandering our way through Hampshire. And we'll be talking a little bit about this because the itinerary, or the geist, I never know how to say that word. How do you say it, Nat?
I think I've taken to saying geists, but it could be anything really.
Yeah, I think geist sounds too much like lots of geese. So I think geist is probably the way to go. So the geist or the itinerary, the couple diverge from that during this particular leg of the progress. And maybe we'll talk a little bit about why and what they did and where they went. So yes, we're going to be going from Winchester and we're going to be wending our way through all sorts of parts of Hampshire. We'll be back into Wiltshire very briefly before we start heading back into Hampshire again and to the Vine, where, as I say, we'll be saying cheerio to Natalie and heading on our way as Vanessa rejoins us, in fact, for the final two podcasts. Okay, so shall we kick off? What do you want to talk about first, Natalie? We're at Winchester. Do you want to just remind us what has happened there?
Sure. So we're at Winchester. We had the consecration that people might remember of some reforming bishops that were, you know, we can call them Anne's men. Mm. And we talked about how important that was and how the cream of the English nobility were there to witness this incredible event. And Henry had needed all the support he can get. So he had recalled a lot of the nobles to come to Winchester. We mentioned that Charles Brandon turns up and he's only just had a baby boy. We have the Duke of Norfolk, who is not pleased that he's been recalled from hunting with his friends in order to serve Anne and the king, but he's there also. So there are people coming and joining the progress at this point in order to really show their support for Henry and Anne and the event that's taking place there in Winchester.
Yeah, a bit of a three-line whip, though. You get the feeling, don't you? It's one of those, it's a bit like Anne's coronation, where it's like, you better turn up whether you want to be there or not.
Absolutely, yeah.
So the couple lodge at Winchester for part of this part of the progress, but there's a slight complicating factor because we know from the records that they also spent a little bit of time in nearby Bishop's Waltham. Now, it's not entirely clear kind of exactly when they were at Winchester, exactly when they were at Bishop's Waltham. It could be that, in fact, the, you know, a part of the court lodged at Bishop's Waltham, and Henry and Anne were with the court at some point there and then came to Winchester for this ceremony of consecration. We don't really know, but we do know that they were at this place called Bishop's Waltham towards the end of September, because that's where we are now. We're at the end of the summer. Autumn is starting to creep across the landscape. And Bishop's Waltham was, in fact, a palace. There was a palace there, and it belonged to the bishops of Winchester. So at the time of the progress, and I can't remember whether we mentioned this last time, but the Bishop of Winchester was Stephen Gardiner, who is a very interesting character. And I think a little bit like William Paulet, who we will meet at Basing House, kind of cut his cloth a little bit to the circumstances unfolding around him. So he kind of backed the wrong horse in the King's Great Matter, but did some fancy footwork and managed to get back on side with Henry, and in fact ended up getting the position as Bishop of Winchester. And of course, he would go on to greater things under the reign of Mary I. But for the meantime, he had a beautiful palace at Bishop's Waltham. It was a large, it was sort of a single courtyard house, but the courtyard was divided into north and south sections. So with the courtiers' lodgings in the north section of the courtyard and all the privy lodgings in the south section. And I'm not going to talk too much about that building, but you can still go and see it today. It's owned by English Heritage. It is in ruins. Unfortunately, it was one of those victims of the English Civil War. And of course, once it was slighted, the local villagers as ever came and kind of pinched bits of building material. So we're left really with only the ruins. But if you do go to Nat today, you can see kind of the impression of the Great Hall. And critically, you can see the West Tower, which is where the most privy lodgings would have been. And I know you and I have come to learn over time that, of course, when Anne and Henry or any royal couple visited any kind of building, the host would cede their rooms to the king and queen. So I think we can probably safely imagine that Henry and Anne lodged in that tower. So you can still go and gaze upon the kind of the ruins of the tower, the ragged remains of the windows and the fireplaces, and kind of imagine the beautiful scenery, because this place at some point would have been surrounded by forest. Not so today, of course. It's been urbanized a little bit, but a pretty little town there still today at Bishop's Waltham. So the stay in Winchester, therefore, draws to a close. And what happens from here, Natalie? Can you tell us where the progress goes?
Yes, absolutely. So we think around the 30th of September, the royal couple leave Winchester. Now, by this point, they'd actually been on progress for around 3 months. So it's already a very extensive time away from London. And of course, they'd been indulging in their shared passions. And we'll talk a little bit more about it after, but riding and hunting and hawking. And of course, music. They were both, you know, ardent music lovers and accomplished instrumentalists. So that was, of course, happening daily, as well as other things, the business side of things. They travelled to Southampton. So we know that they travelled to Southampton. This is, in fact, quite interesting because it is the first major change to that royal itinerary, or the Geists that we were talking about earlier. So they may have stayed at the castle in Southampton. We're not 100% sure, because by this point, unfortunately, the accounts that we've been using to really follow in the footsteps of this royal progress come to an end. So they're the controller's accounts, and they don't survive for this period. So we have to rely on other sources now.
Can I ask you, do we know why they went off-piste with the itinerary?
That's such a good question, Sarah. And really, the only thing that I can really put it down to is that they were having a fantastic time. And I sort of feel like there was a little bit of a reluctance to return to real life, I suppose you can say, and back to the business of governing the nation. Because remember, this is a time of turmoil. You know, there's so much going on, and they're kind of living in this little bubble at the moment, traveling around the countryside, enjoying themselves. But there is the threat of war on their doorstep. So perhaps it had something to do with that.
Yeah, well, we can all relate to that feeling, can't we, about not wanting to come back from holidays. So just they had the means to, you know, determine what they did. So yeah, they really do go off piste here. And we see that the progress kind of get elongated by how long does they were supposed to be, this was supposed to be done and dusted in how long, and how long did it take them in the end?
Exactly. So they were supposed to leave Winchester and basically start heading home and be home within a week. And instead, they take a very leisurely route, which takes them about 1 month. So it's a significant extension to the progress.
It really is, isn't it? Now, Southampton's an interesting place. Obviously, it's a major city today. I visited. There's not too much of the Tudor city left to see. You have to use a bit of your imagination. There's one of the gates of the city. But there is a beautiful Tudor house there that's one of the contenders for where Henry and Anne stayed. The castle has gone. But what about this other one? What can you tell us about this other location?
So the house at Southampton, I believe now, and I think, Sarah, you visited, is called the Tudor House Museum. Is that you?
Yes,
went there,
it
didn't
is.
You?
Yeah.
Yeah. And at the time of Henry and Anne's visit, that was owned by a man called Sir Richard Lister. So he was a very prominent and important person in the town. So as we know from past experience, you know, a lot of the times these people would host the royal party, at least for a short stay. So that's what we think happened on this particular occasion.
Yeah, I'm trying to drag this out from my memory, but I'm sure he played quite an important role, either in the divorce from Catherine or the annulment from Catherine, and or in Anne Boleyn's coronation. So he's one of these characters you don't normally hear about, but he was there in the thick of it.
I actually think you're right. I think he actually played a role in both of those that you just mentioned. So I think he played some part in the annulment and then was also there present and supporting the king and queen on, you know, at Anne's coronation. So these people are favoured, definitely.
Yeah. And then, you know, going back to the same scenario we have at Winchester and Bishop's Waltham, it wouldn't surprise me if a large number of people of the court lodged in the castle and maybe in other houses in the town. And if Henry and Anne did lodge in Tudor House, then that would make sense to me. And if they didn't lodge there, I could well imagine them being hosted there for a lovely dinner while they were in Southampton.
Yeah, absolutely. And as we know, with the, you know, houses of people like Sir Richard Lister, they're not going to be able to house the whole court, not even, you know, huge palaces could. So it's a definite, I think, that the court would have been split at this point, you know, other accommodation found for other members, while Anne and Henry, of course, stay in the most lavish of accommodation.
And, you know, we were just talking about eating, and I think one of the things that made me smile when we were researching Southampton was this description of a porpoise being delivered to Thomas Cromwell to enjoy. We'll talk about a little bit about him at the moment. But so what, a dolphin? That I presume. I don't know. Dolphin?
I think so. And it's interesting you mentioned that, because this is one of the things that has been really eye-opening in my research this year. The gifts, the range of gifts that Thomas Cromwell and other people, but Cromwell in particular, was receiving is incredible. Everything, as you say, from porpoise to all kinds of birds, you know, cash and anything else that you can think of, he is receiving as gifts.
It's a mark of the man's status. So why don't we just touch on that for a moment? Because Thomas Cromwell has been with us on Progress since Sudeley Castle. So he's come on a really significant chunk. But what happens from here?
So he's still with the court at this point, which is interesting because sometimes people say he had left by this point. But no, he's definitely still there because he is still attending to different correspondence and writing letters. But he's preparing to return home. There's things that can't be left anymore. He needs to go back to London and take care of business.
Yeah. So he kind of heads off shortly after that. And you're right. We kind of normally records point to the fact that Thomas Cromwell had gone by then, but I think that's something that emerged from our digging around that actually, no, he was still with the court. But what do we know what Henry and Anne did in Southampton? Or if we don't know, what happened next?
No, I don't think, unfortunately, we don't have the sort of detail that we had for some other locations. However, Henry is attending to some, you know, letters, and he's maybe working a bit more than he has while he was in Winchester. So that's all we sort of know of that place. But what does happen is that on Monday, the 4th of October, Henry and Anne actually sail from Southampton to Portsmouth in one of Lord Lyell's ships. And they're actually going to inspect the king's fleet. which includes, and perhaps some listeners have heard of, the Henry Grace Adieu, which we commonly call the Great Harry. And so they go there. Possibly the king was so concerned with the threat of warfare that he has gone to make sure that, you know, his fleet is in order and they're ready to serve if needed. So they stay there only for a short time. And then they head to Portchester, where, again, we believe that they lodged at the castle there.
Mm. And again, that's for those people who maybe don't know the area. The ruins of Portchester Castle still remain. I think it's a really ancient site, actually. I think the Romans had a lot to do with Portchester. And during the medieval period, if I'm pulling this out of my mind, I'm trying to drag down my memories. I think also various medieval English kings used it as an embarkation point for setting off to the continent. So it'd been quite an important area. And today you can still see a very, very large, I mean, it's huge kind of courtyard area. And then in one section of it, you have the remnants of the castle and, of course, the privy apartments. But it's quite small, Portchester. You know, the actual privy apartments themselves are quite small. So, again, I don't know whether there's lots of ancillary lodgings around kind of the courtyard or whether, you know, whoever was traveling with the court made use of other lodgings, but it would have been quite cramped, I think, in Portchester Castle itself.
And yes, and there's always the possibility of tents, and I think we'll mention this again soon. However, you know, and when you think tents, you know, you might think of the one you stayed in when you were camping with your family. However, these were, of course, much larger tents and quite lavish. However, they were very commonly used to support, you know, the accommodation needs, because this is a lot of people traveling around at the same time.
Yeah, absolutely. So they didn't stay at Portchester very long, did they?
No, they didn't. So before long, they were back in the saddles and they were heading again via Southampton, but this time to Salisbury in Wiltshire, as you mentioned earlier. And that's where they are. We know they're there on the 9th of October. Again, just like at Gloucester that we talked about, that magnificent reception. There were plans for a really, you know, lavish ceremony here at Salisbury. However, we unfortunately don't know the details, because all that survives is the sort of discussion that was happening before the couple arrived, a few things that they were going to do. We do know that they were going to have some torches ready in case they arrived after dark. And I always love that kind of imagery of thinking of Anne and Henry, you know, riding or walking and people, torchbearers following them along, the flicker of the candlelights. I think that's really lovely. However, we don't have the detail that we had for Gloucester.
Yeah, it's such a shame, because you imagine Salisbury was such an important city. Henry had been, I think, in the past, I think with Catherine of Aragon, if I remember rightly. I think so. Sorry if I'm leading anybody astray there, but I'm fairly sure he'd visited previously, and being an important city, there must have been pomp and ceremony. They must have visited the cathedral. It's almost unthinkable that they didn't do that.
Oh, yes. We know that they tend to follow patterns, as we've seen, which is helpful when we're trying to work out what they were doing and their movements. And they always visited the main cathedral or church, you know, to give thanks and receive gifts. Often gifts were exchanged at the accommodation or at the main location, and just for people to come and see them, basically. So I have no doubt that they visited Salisbury, yeah.
And the location in which they stayed, which we unearthed during our research, was quite exciting, because it's still there. You can still see it's actually still owned by the Diocese of Salisbury, or at least it was when I visited it several years ago. But do you want to tell us a little bit about that place, that building, that location?
Actually, I'm wondering again if this is one that you visited, Sarah. I have a feeling that you were really excited when you went to Salisbury, got excited lots of times during the research and writing of our books. But so I believe, and correct me if I'm not wrong, that it is the present day church house, which is on the south side of Crane Street, which I'm imagining is the high street or the main street.
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously in the centre. It's a stone's throw from the cathedral. It actually sits adjacent to the river. So there's a river runs exactly by the side of it. There's a lovely little bridge going over it. And it's a medieval building. So it's an old building. It had been around for a little bit of time, I think, before, and had several iterations. And again, if I remember rightly, I'm sure that one of those iterations, it was called the Falcon, I've got a feeling. So I always thought that was really interesting, of course, with the connection with Anne. So yes, it does still exist today and it's still in use.
Yeah, that's wonderful. And actually, in Salisbury, we actually have a little bit of an insight as to one thing that occurred while the couple are in Salisbury, and that is the location where Henry VIII decided that the Princess Elizabeth, so their daughter, should be weaned, and actually ordered the old Palace of Langley to be prepared for her, although it turns out that she didn't stay there. She stayed somewhere else. However, so it's interesting, I suppose, to think of Henry and Anne having these discussions. We can't know for certain that Anne took part in them, but I think given what we know of her and her love for her daughter and, you know, her personality, I think she would have had her 2 cents worth in that discussion, definitely.
Yeah, I'd say for sure. Yeah. And of course, lovely listeners out there, you ran, you walked, you cycled to the old Palace of Langley. So this is somewhere that you've been on this particular progress. So you've got a little bit of an idea about where it is and kind of what went on there. Good. So I think what we're going to do is we're going to take Henry and Anne to their next location and then maybe talk a little bit about the pastime and pleasure enjoyed by the royal couple. So they were in Salisbury. What happened next, Nat?
So they're in Salisbury and then they decided to make a visit. And I think this is all to do, Sarah, with pleasure, by the way.
I do too.
A visit to the palace and the park of Clarendon. So this is really close to Salisbury. It's not far at all. And this is around the 10th of October. Again, it's tricky because remember, we don't have those accounts anymore and people are coming and going. And so it's tricky, but it would have been around the 10th of October. And they only stayed probably for a couple of days. So this is a place that in its heyday was, you know, one of the richest hunting parks in the country. It has very long royal connections. Lots of royalty passed, you know, English royalty stayed there and hunted there. And it's known for being somewhere really isolated and quiet. So you can understand after having traveled with hundreds of people for 3.5 months that they maybe want a little bit of peace and quiet in, you know, beautiful, lush surroundings. And this is exactly what this was, for pleasure and relaxation.
So with that, I think we should just take a moment to talk a little bit about how a royal couple like Henry and Anne would relax and would how they would take their pleasure during a royal progress. Okay, good so far? Good so far. So Nat, we talked already actually on a few occasions about that our records of Henry and Anne being merry, particularly in Hampshire, something about Hampshire, I think we all need to go. There must be something in the air. But what can you tell us a little bit more about that? What was going on and what does that mean exactly? They were merry.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes. So I know I want to go to Hampshire and find out what happens in Hampshire because something was going on. There are no less than 4 or possibly 5 references to the couple, Anne and Henry specifically, being merry in Hampshire. So merry in the 16th century had a similar meaning to how we would express happiness now or say that somebody's happy. The difference is with happy, and I just wanted to point this out because obviously Anne's motto is the most happy. And obviously sometimes people suggest that that's perhaps her being a little haughty and saying that she's the happiest woman in the world and look what happens to her and all that kind of thing. However, in fact, happy had a connotation of being lucky. So in fact, what Anne is saying is that she's the luckiest woman because Henry has singled her out amongst all the other women and raised her to be queen. So it's a completely, I suppose, different meaning to the merry. If she had said she's the most merry, which would have been an interesting thing. But most happy has more of a meaning to do with luck, that she's been lucky because Henry singled her out. But the fact that they're merry is really interesting because, and I think you'll probably get to this in the next episode, Sarah, there is something that's about to happen that's going to change things in Anne's life. And so there is a definite sense that there is a renewed closeness between the couple, that there's an intimacy that perhaps had been lost there for a little while because of all the stresses, and that the fact that now they've spent time, possibly some time, you know, quite a bit of time alone, doing these things that they love that we're going to chat about, has really brought them closer together. And now they've retreated to this little quiet, secluded spot at Clarendon, and you just feel this sense of renewed intimacy between the couple.
Yeah, yeah. The rapprochement between Henry and Anne. And it's a lovely time for us lovers of Anne Boleyn to imagine her so happy, although, of course, it's a little bittersweet knowing what's coming next. Okay, so what we really wanted to do was to dive in and talk about some of the pastimes and pleasures enjoyed by Henry and Anne. I would point people towards a book by Alison Sim called Pleasures and Pastimes in Tudor England, if you want to know more on this subject. Now, we're not going to talk about all the pleasures and pastimes associated with Tudor England, because if I read you a little list, you'll see that we could be here for the rest of the day. So this included board games, cards, dancing, dicing, theatre, masks, fishing, football, tennis, wrestling, cockfighting and bear baiting and bull baiting, not something we would particularly enjoy today. Running at the quintain, if you were a young man, learning how to joust. And even public executions were considered a form of pastime. You know, you would get whole families going along for a day out and probably taking along the equivalent of a picnic, you know, to see particularly the notable and the wealthy being executed. Again, it's just so sick making to us, but, you know, different times, a different lens. But what we wanted to focus on were particularly perhaps a couple of those pursuits which were really associated with aristocratic England, and that's hunting and hawking. And we constantly hear about Henry and Anne and, of course, other, you know, royalty during the Tudor period, hunting and hawking. And they spent most of their days outdoors. That's probably the first thing that we should say. If the weather allowed, they would be outdoors. And so these were two fine sports. And as I mentioned, particularly associated with the wealthy, because they were actually expensive to do. So maybe we'll take the first of those and talk a little bit about hunting. So hunting was expensive because you needed a place to lodge all your hounds, your dogs. You needed horses. You needed people to care for all these animals and feed all these animals. And so that in itself required, you know, a certain amount of wealth and money. So it was really the preserve of those who were in the upper echelons of Tudor society. Of course, you also needed a place to hunt. So you need a park. You needed a hunting park. And these were enclosed spaces, usually with, and Clarendon was no exception. It had a huge hunting park, and it's usually enclosed by a ditch or a fence, and that would keep the deer inside. So you would hunt within that particular area. I mean, these could be thousands of acres, these hunting parks. So they were big. And of course, once you'd actually got all your pack, your horses out, you could put on your finery and you could head out and be seen. So again, in Tudor society, a time where sort of being seen and an ostentatious display of wealth was quite acceptable. Now, this was a perfectly normal and appropriate thing to do. But the other really interesting thing about hunting is it, particularly during the earlier medieval period, it had a dual purpose. It wasn't just about pleasure. It was actually something that prepared young men for warfare. And in fact, I've pulled out a quote that I found, which really kind of captures this idea. And it said that hunting, which in those earlier days was more about wild hunting, increaseth in them being young men, increasing in them both agility and quickness, also sleight and policy to find such passages and straits where they may prevent or trap their enemies. Also by continuance therein, they shall easily sustain travail in wars, hunger and thirst, cold and heat. So it was a bit of rough in it, I think, is what he's trying to say, associated with kind of early forms of hunting. But I do think it's probably appropriate to say, as kind of the Tudor period seems to wear on, it becomes a little more civilized and a little more genteel, and certainly something that the ladies could take part in. Because as the 16th century wears on, we see that there were things like what it was called actually bow and stable hunt, which is where the hunters would gather in one place and then the deer would be driven across the path of the hunters. And all they would do would have to stand there with their bows and arrows or their crossbows and take the deer out as they ran by. So it's kind of a very low impact version of hunting. And to make things even more comfortable, there was often like a bower, so a shelter somewhere where they could kind of keep out of the any worst of the weather, I suppose, if the weather was to turn on them. So yeah, certainly not preparing them for warfare there, don't you think?
No. And we do have records of men taking part in that kind of hunting. A French ambassador, I think, at some point says, oh, that Henry put him with Anne in order to hunt like that. But we know that she also, Sarah, which I find so interesting, participated in, you know, the traditional hunting. And I think that is such an interesting insight into Anne's level of fitness. I just think she must have been incredibly fit and probably quite toned and maybe sun-kissed, you know, spending time outdoors, riding with this, you know, group of men, probably a lot of time, and other women, and keeping up with them. We know Henry could tire horse after horse after horse, you know, and go out before the sun's come up and come home when it's dark. So exhausting, real cardio workout.
Total cardio workout. And we saw in Gloucester, didn't we, how they were out all day and they came back, you know, with after dark. And but also the fact that they lodged or stopped off at various different major houses, manor houses along the way to take rest and refreshment. So you can imagine it was kind of on, off, on, off. But yeah, hugely exhilarating and physically so demanding. And I still think I've yet to find a great source that confirms 100% to me whether women hunted side saddle or astride and what they wore. Because having worn a French gown myself, I cannot imagine riding a horse full tilt in a French gown. I mean, maybe they did, I don't know, but maybe they wore the English gown, which seems to be much less fitted. It wasn't fitted around the waist so much. The sleeves were less embellished. Maybe that makes sense that it would be more easy to hunt like that. But when I've researched hunting, I've really not found much apart from one woodcut of Elizabeth. She's in a later gown. It's more English in style. And she's slitting that she has a knife in her hand because obviously she's applied the final blow to kill the heart. But I found so little. I don't know whether you've, in your continued research, Natalie, found anything else that answers either of those questions more definitively.
No, you know what? This is one of those frustrating things because, as you say, we can assume that there was, you know, a different kind of gown or something that they're wearing. The only record that I can remember, the earliest record we think for a riding gown for a woman, is in Elizabeth of York's privy purse expenses. So this is going back, you know, the start of the 16th century, and she is having riding gowns made for her. So we know there was something different about them. Unfortunately, because it's just assumed that everyone would know what these are, the details are just not given. So I know sometimes it's sort of erroneously said that these didn't come out until late Elizabethan, but we know for sure that Elizabeth of York is having specific clothing made for when she is out riding. So there's no doubt that Anne would have had the same, would have been incredibly stylish, I'm sure. But yes, hopefully more comfortable for a day in the saddle.
I hope so indeed. But, you know, one of the other things I found really interesting about hunting is that it was a total art form in a way. It's a little bit like the English have, I can't remember how many words we have for rain, but we have a lot of words for rain because it rains a lot. It's like the Eskimos have a lot of words for snow because there's a lot of discernment. And what I didn't realize until actually just doing a little bit of research for this podcast was that deer have different names depending on the age of the deer. And of course, any Tudor person would have known that. So, for example, a one-year-old male deer was called a calso. A second-year-old male deer was called a brocket. And so on it goes on until you get to a male deer of 6 years of age and above. And that is called the hart. And that was the pinnacle of hunting. So you would try and bring down a hart. And we know, I think you mentioned it just earlier on in this podcast, deer were one of those presents that were seen as, you know, a really appropriate high status gift. And in fact, I think the earliest record that we have of Henry sending Anne a present was a buck that he had killed the day before. So yeah, you're kind of like, a dead deer? Is that all you can manage? But it was totally de rigueur at the time, wasn't it?
Oh, absolutely. It's, you know, caught up in all ideas of honor and chivalry and things like that. So I know today we might, and I know you, Sarah, being a vegetarian, I don't think you'd be very impressed with a gift of a deer or a heart for your table. No. However, at the time, this was really high status gift giving. And we pretty much see it throughout every progress as they're moving around the country. People are sending them, you know, exactly as you said, a deer for the table or a heart for the table or a buck for the table, something for the table. So yeah, this is quite common.
So I think that's kind of captures the essence of what hunting was all about. Obviously, they also hunted to seasons, and because they didn't want to hunt when the does were pregnant and so on and so forth. So there were seasons for hunting and there were seasons for hawking, which is what we're going to just talk a little bit about. Now, I don't claim to be an expert on hawking, falconry, etc. I have spoken to experts when I was writing Le Temps Viendre, a novel of Anne Boleyn, because there are several scenes in there where Anne is out hawking, one in particular, and I really wanted to get the detail of that right. So I'm drawing upon what I've learned from others, but you know, I'm not an expert. But again, there's nuances to this that we've just lost, I think, to time. But again, it was preserve of the wealthy. Why? Because the birds, you had to look after the birds, you had to train the birds, you had to have keepers of the birds. And the birds themselves, as I will talk about just in a moment, could be incredibly expensive. But in terms of what birds they would fly, it seems to me that there are basically two main types. There were hawks and there were falcons. And they hunted different prey and they killed their prey in a different way as well. So hawks, perhaps one of the most common, and in fact, one type of hawk was called the cook bird, precisely because you could rely on it to kill a lot of prey and you could bring back a lot of prey with it. Now, the natural prey for a hawk are things like rabbits, rats, small mammals like voles, mice, etc. Now, obviously, they would be more looking to kill things like rabbits, conies, I think they're called, rabbits. If you ever read a Tudor text and you hear them having conies at the table, that's a rabbit. So that would be one of the most popular forms of prey. And the hawks actually kill prey by crushing the skull with their mighty talons. So that's how they tend to dispatch a prey. So you would find an appropriate piece of land that would likely have that type of prey. And you would have the bird and you'd cast it off, which is the technical name for sending a bird off in flight. And the bird would just swoop down and swoop down and basically crush the prey, the skull of the prey with its talons. And then you'd get the falconers running in with bits of liver to feed the bird, because obviously you didn't want the bird then to tear apart the rabbit. You wanted the rabbit to look good for the table. So you had to reward it and you'd give it a little bit of liver, etc. So of course, I'm imagining that most of this was done from horseback. I'm not entirely sure, but you could imagine them on horseback. I don't know. Maybe they dismounted, but you just needed to be able to cast the bird off from your fist, your gloved fist. And the other type of bird was a falcon. And now, obviously, falcon, Anne Boleyn badge, you know, it's all very interesting, isn't it? And the Anne Boleyn badge falcon was white, was it not, Natalie?
It was, yep, exactly.
And so as far as I could make out from my research, the white falcon has a particular name. It's called the gerfalcon. So that's G-R-Y-F-A-L-C-O-N, gerfalcon. And it's a very specific breed that comes from the Arctic coasts and tundra and the islands of North America and the Euro-Siberian region, right? So this is a very, they had to import them for a start. This is not a native bird. Now, they, you know, high status nobility did own these white falcons for sure, but they were very temperamental. So the other thing to know about certain birds is some birds were easier to fly than others, and gear falcons were very temperamental, very difficult to fly. I think they're quite large birds as well, so they're very heavy. So you wouldn't normally get a woman flying one of the larger falcons. They would normally fly a much smaller falcon, which was called a merlin. That was very much a lady's bird. But I talked about expense, and it was interesting, again, as I was preparing for this podcast, I was just sort of doing a little bit of research. And they still, you know, buy and sell gear falcons today. And the Middle East is a big falconry. They're really into their falconry in the Middle East. There's a big trade in birds. And quite recently, I think it was back, yes, it was actually only last year, in Saudi Arabia, a white gear falcon was sold for the equivalent of £337,000. So they were enormously expensive. So it would be like in Tudor times, you know, I don't know, I can't give an exact equivalent, but, you know, like buying your top of the range sports car, basically, with all the bells and whistles associated with it. And in fact, that particular auction was a world record for the sale of any bird. So they're still highly prized today. But falcons killed different prey. They tend to hunt other birds. And the way they work is that they are able to fly faster and higher than other birds that they hunt, like, for example, a pigeon. So you'd cast the bird off and it would gain height going above a bird of prey that would be below it, its prey. And then it would sort of swoop and dive and try and kind of tire out the prey before catching it literally on the wing. And a falcon has a little notch in its beak, and it uses that to basically sever, I presume, the artery or the neck of the bird and kill them that way. So different style of hunting for different birds, got you different types of prey. But as you can see, that it was very much, again, a display of wealth, because when you went out onto the field, you would have your birds carried on a canch, which was like a wooden frame. And that the person responsible for carrying the cadge was a cadger. And, you know, it would be, I imagine you would kind of, you could well easily kind of process along the high street as you were heading out from your manor or your castle or wherever. But you would be seen again in a kind of an ostentatious display of wealth, as well as then to be going into the field and enjoying a lovely day's hunting. So that's my very, very potted kind of explanation of what hunting and hawking was all about. As I say, I'm not an expert. I hope I've got that as accurate as possible for you lovely listeners out there.
No, that sounds really good. And I was just thinking to myself, Sarah, that also, you know, a mark of obviously your wealth, as you've said, but also your level of education, because you imagine that this, if you have time to learn all of these skills, then it does point to quite a high status education as well, which we know this is part of what noble children and wealthy, you know, children learned how to do from a very young age.
Yeah, it's a good point. It's a really, really good point. You had to have a very well-rounded education. And we know that Anne Boleyn in particular was considered incredibly well-educated for a Renaissance woman. So she would have been skilled in all of these different pastimes and pleasures. Okay, well, that was a little bit of a foray into the world of Tudor pastime and pleasure, and jolly nice it is too. I love a bit of falconry myself. I don't know about Nat. Have you had a go at falconry?
I haven't had a try. No, I think I need to.
Oh my goodness, you certainly do.
Absolutely. I'm a bit scared because there's quite a large bird that flies at you quite quickly, high speed.
Oh yes, so I'll have to get you doing that. That's a must. Anyway, we are coming towards the end of this leg of the progress. We are at Clarendon and the old palace of Clarendon, which was once a very, very popular medieval palace for the Lancastrian kings, but was falling into disrepair actually by the 16th century. We're not in fact sure whether the actual palace itself would have still been habitable. There are no records of it being sort of kept up and repaired in the few decades prior to Anne and Henry being there. So it is possible there was a hunting lodge in the area, and we know there was because Elizabeth I would later go and stay in that hunting lodge. And again, going back to the idea of tents, this would have been perfect. You know, the place was surrounded by woodland and it would have been a lovely place to sort of set your tents up. So we don't know exactly where they stay. We just know that they did visit there. And in fact, if you go and visit today, you cannot drive to the site, which makes it still so isolated and peaceful. You really get a sense of what it might have been like. You have to walk from Salisbury, and there are walking maps that show you how to get there. And you end up walking along some of these old, ancient sort of pathways that lead you towards the entrance to the palace or the old palace. And there were very scant remains. There's a few walls, a bit of an imprint in the ground, there's a couple of notice boards, and lots of llamas. Just have to say, the field in which these remains are, at least when I visited, were inhabited by very curious llamas who will come over to say hello, sniff you, and then get very bored and walk away. So do not be afeard. They are very, very tame, or they were when I was there. But yeah, it's so peaceful because you can't drive to the place. Of course, you have the place to yourself, and that sense of isolation is absolutely wonderful.
Well, they're my favorite places, as you know, Sarah. I love imagining, you know, what was there and getting the vibe of the place. So that sounds delightful.
So we leave Clarendon kind of roughly when and where, what happens next? What do we know of that, Natalie?
So I think, look, it's got to be around middle of October, around about there. We don't know exactly. And it really is time to go home now. This is coming up to almost 4 months by this point, 3.5, 4 months. So And the landscape has changed. They definitely know they've been on progress for many months. They begin their journey home, Sarah. So packing up all the carts and the bags and everything else and starting their journey to Windsor.
So they're heading in an eastwards direction. It is worth noting that really frustratingly, this is the segment of the journey home where we're missing probably at, I don't know, 3 or 4 locations maybe along the way. We don't know where they stayed. And it's just so frustrating because we have all the other locations. So there is a little bit of a gap. But we do know that they are heading for the next recorded stop, which is the Vine in Hampshire, which is a grand house and one that I'll be talking about with Vanessa in the next podcast. So we really are coming to the end of this podcast, folks. You are heading home. So well done if you've got this far. I know some of you will be doing this solo. Others of you will be running as a team. But whatever you're doing, I hope you've enjoyed and been merry in Hampshire. Managed to find some pleasure and merry disport along the way. And it is, in fact, time to say goodbye to Natalie. So I just wanted to say, Natalie, thank you so much for joining us on our progress so far and sharing your insight and knowledge that you've gained about researching this progress in Anne Boleyn. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Sarah. It's been so lovely. I always love to chat with you. And thank you to everyone who is listening for allowing me to go on progress with you. And I wish you all the very best for the last couple of legs of your journey.
Okay, folks. So that's us done for today. And you will rendezvous again with Vanessa and I at the Vine. So happy running, happy walking, happy cycling. And we'll see you again soon.